I will refer to the parties that they were in the trial court. The petitioner was the plaintiff in the trial court, and the defendant is the respondent in this court. I will argue the points that have been granted related to the Consumer Protection Act, Section 17.46B5, 1746B7, and recovery under 1750A2. Mr. Maxwell will argue the points of the court concerning the requirement of intent to deceive under 1746A of the Act, the constitutionality of 1746A, the waiver of the constitutionality points, and the wrongful intent required under 1750A3 of the Act. This was a non-jury case. Judgment was entered under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act by the trial court. This case is before the court without a statement of fact. The trial court's findings, basically summarized, are that the defendant sold to the plaintiff a used boat in May of 1975. Leading up to the sale of that boat, the defendant made four representations to the plaintiff that worked. I think that this ought to be accentuated at this time, that worked, not repairs. Finding of the trial court is not that repairs representation was made at that time, but that work had been performed on the boat, making it in excellent condition, perfect condition, and just like new. The trial court found that this was not puffing or opinion by the defendant, but that this was statements of fact, that these were statements of material fact, that the defendant made these statements to the plaintiff with the intention that the plaintiff would rely on these statements in the purchase of the boat, that the plaintiff did rely on these statements in the purchase of the boat and would not have purchased the boat but for these statements being made by the defendant, that the statements were false, that because the statements are, that there was repairs that had to be performed on the boat within approximately 2 months after the boat was bought by the plaintiff in the amount of $481.68. That the boat, at the time of the sale, the boat and motor, was in inadequate condition for the uses intended. That the statements that had been made by the defendant, besides being false, were additionally misleading and had resulted in unconscionable results to the plaintiff. The findings of the trial court submitted that $981.68 would be the recovery in this case because of three reasons. One was a stipulation of $500 by the party prior to the trial, which the court looked upon to be taken into consideration concerning treble damages section of the Act. Further, that $981.68, aside from that, was to restore a portion of the money that had been acquired by the defendant in violation of the Act. And third, that the amount of $981.68 was a proper relief under the Act. That the plaintiff was a consumer and that the goods, that the boat and motor were good under the Act. And therefore, the trial court made a conclusion of law that the plaintiff was entitled to recover under the Consumer Protection Act. I think before any of the points should be argued, we need to look at the general law in a no statement of fact case, such as before the court. All facts are presumed, were submitted and tried at the case, at trial, to support the findings of fact filed by the trial judge that's before you in the record, and the judgment. If one element, and only one element, of any ground of recovery, under any of the sections, is found and included in those findings of fact, then any omitted findings are presumed to have been found by the trial court in support of the judgment under that ground of recovery. And last, it's to be presumed in the no statement of fact case that issues outside the pleadings were tried by express or implied consent to support the judgment. they must be treated as raised by the pleading in the no statement of fact case. Now, turning to liability under Section 1746B5 and 1746B7. Those provide the liability of false, misleading, or deceptive acts or practice if goods or services are represented under Section 5, subsection 5, to have, among other things, characteristics or uses which they do not have. Subsection B provides that a person representing that goods or services are of a particular standard or quality when they are another is also a misleading, false, misleading, or deceptive act or practice. If you go to the Webster's Dictionary in the Supreme Court Law Library here, and you look up the definitions of the various words such as characteristics, uses, standards, and qualities, as well as some of the actual findings of the trial court concerning excellent, perfect, like new, condition, you're going to see that these overlap. You're going to see that B and 7 have synonyms for the very terms that are included. I think that they do overlap to be sure, and the legislature did this, to be sure that the ingenuity of man in avoiding what would be false, misleading, or deceptive acts would be difficult, that it would be covered, however you wanted to look at it. The Court of Civil Appeals, in this case, on their opinion on motion for rehearing, when they reversed and rendered against the plaintiff, after they had affirmed in their original opinion for the plaintiff, have held that 1746B5 concerning characteristics, benefits, is talking about goods when they are in a proper condition or in good working order. Assuming those things, then what are their characteristics or uses? The court really does not cite any authority other than that what I submit, the plaintiff submits, it would like for the act to be. But there's no legal authority in the cited by the court. There's no reading of the act that can justify such a definition or restriction in 1746B5. And if you look at the fact that or services are included in this very section, how could you have services not having their characteristics or uses if you said that a service has to be when it's in proper condition? When is a service in proper condition? When is a service in good working order? In other words, transpose what the service where the Court of Civil Appeals said good, because they're the same in this section. And you can see that that does not coincide. Services are not in proper condition or in good working order unless you look at when a person gets up in the morning and he takes his vitamins and has his breakfast, then he's in good working order that day. But I don't submit that that is what the legislature meant when it said this. Characteristics and uses, if a boat is in like news, if a boat is in excellent condition, that tells you that you can use that boat as a new boat would be used. That it has the characteristics of excellence. That it has the characteristics of a new boat, what that connotates to a person, as opposed to a used boat, as opposed to a boat that has not been brought into that condition, not by repairs as found by the trial court, as being the representation that created the right in this case, not the breach thereof later on down the road, but the right created by that representation at that time of work, not repair.
Leading, say an examination has the characteristics of an audit.
Well,
it's just saying the characteristics cannot be applied to services in the sense that it was applied by the court of goods, and I'm just not sure that that's correct.
Your question was audit and examination. Is that correct? Okay. Was the audit, if you use the definition of the Court of Civil Appeals, was the audit in proper condition? Was the audit in good working order? That is the definition that... No, but the Court of Civil Appeals, in its opinion...
A proper audit, in other words, an audit carried out the way an audit is normally carried out, has certain characteristics, certain things are done. Examination carried out in ordinary way has certain things are done. And if you ascribe one, those characteristics to one when you're talking about the other one, then isn't that what should be talked about here in section 5?
It could be talked about, but you have to, and that could be one of the purposes and things that could cause a violation of that section. But it must be remembered under 1744 that the act is to be given a liberal construction. And you shouldn't try to restrict it down to its most potentially limited application or technical application or what the court in its feelings or beliefs should be the definition of characteristics, but what the legislature has said.
I can understand that argument, but what I can't understand is the argument you cannot apply the same reasoning to services that you can to goods that the Court of Appeals.
You possibly can in that example, but let's say that
benefits, can't give benefits, an audit has certain benefits, and examination has certain benefits performed properly.
When it's done in proper condition or proper working order?
Right. What does an audit usually do for you? What does it do?
Well, I just don't know how the services, you can say that the service was in proper condition or that the service was in good working order. That's the definition that the Court of Civil Appeals gave.
Properly performed.
If this boat properly performed, it move up. Which it did not.
Doesn't have the characteristics of a properly performing new boat.
Right. And that's the reason I'm saying characteristics can apply as being breached in this case. And as bringing this case under 1746b5, if you give it that definition. But the Court of Civil Appeals, I don't believe, gave it that broad of a definition. It said in proper condition.
I'm not sure what the difference is between proper condition normally. The normal way of doing an audit would be the analog of an improper condition.
I think under 1746, and I don't know if I'm following that train of thought or can respond to it, John. Under 1746, B5, as well as B7 and any of the other sections, it must be remembered that only one element need be located in the findings of fact. Conclusion of the law of the trial court to justify the judgment of the trial court being affirmed under that section. Turning to 1746b7, concerning a particular standard of quality, I again get back to, I don't know of any set standard in the ordinary sense of services, such as that there's a well-recognized, as there is in milk and meat. I realize that there is USDA, that you can find that example, but how about other services? I don't know of any known standard setting a service. And you have to look at that being in the act, see what the purpose and what the intent of the legislature was. I don't think it was to give services the USDA set standard on services. So I don't know of any set standards like that, like there is in milk or meat, the one example that the Court of Civil Appeals used. Turning to 1746A2, express warranty, there were explicit findings of all the elements, I believe, under section 2.313H1 of the UCC code that would justify a warranty being found and breached in this case. Remember, only one element needed to be found. Outside of the UCC, in Wood versus Littleton, this type of representation, this court recognized to create not only a liability under 1746B, on the laundry list, but could also create a warranty, as was done in this case. I'm not putting the argument.
Was warranty pledged by plaintiff?
That gets back to no statement of fact. This court has to presume.
Pledge is not in statement of fact. Yes, it would have said.
It was not said that this is a breach of warranty in the original case. It was not said in so many words.
The trial court, though, made a finding that there was a breach of warranty.
The trial court did not say there was a breach of warranty. And there were no objections or requests for additional amended findings after the trial court filed a finding of fact. Again, pleading first are for setting out facts and then to allow that to come into evidence. Second, there was no statement of fact, and therefore this court has to assume that pleadings, that the matter of a breach of warranty was tried by express and implied consent. Has no alternative. You can't look back to statement of fact and decide whether it was or wasn't, because it's just not recorded. You have to assume we sat there for a week. Under the law, I understand, talks about nothing but breach of warranty, or the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, or whatever, and that was all tried by express consent in the trial court. And it's only one element, i.e. the fact of the affirmation of fact that was relied upon by the plaintiff and intended to by the defendant was found and is in the findings, then you have to assume all other facts to support that judgment.
Hey, this is the court. I'm Phil Maxwell, and I hope I have time to finish today. The unconstitutionality of the act has been raised in two cases before this court, in Riverside National Bank versus Lewis, heard for the second time by this court recently. And in this case, and from an examination of the record in this case, it is clear to me under the law that there has been a waiver of all unconstitutional claims. The law is quite clear that the matter of illegality, of which unconstitutionality is a subpart, must be pled in the answer, or it is a waived defense and may not be considered on appeal. Now, there are other cases cited in the brief. The most recent one on this point is a deceptive trade practice case decided by the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals, Justice Clayton writing for the court. It is not cited in our brief. It is Williams versus McSwain. It is 596 Southwest 2nd 583, with the court states, the remaining points, 16, 17, 18, and 19, attack the constitutionality of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Since no answer was filed, it is obvious that this defense was not pled, and in the amended motion to set aside default judgment and to grant a new trial, this defense was not pled. It is well settled that the unconstitutionality of the statute is an affirmative defense which must be pled. There being no pleading of this affirmative defense, these points are overruled. That same language should have appeared in the Court of Civil Appeals opinion in Singleton versus Penning, but it did not. The court went on, and I think so erroneous. Now, the court dismisses cavalierly these myriad opinions holding that it must be pled on the argument or point that the word Deceptive Trade Practices Act does not appear in the pleading. I think that's a very poor excuse for not following this long line of authority, for the reason that it is clear from every other document coming out of the trial court that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act was involved in the case, was tried, was a part of the judgment. The motion for judgment on file on behalf of the defendant said the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is not applicable to this case. No question that the defendant was arguing the act did not apply, as he pointed out in his brief Court of Civil Appeals originally, and in his brief to this court, figuring that the act did not apply to a one-time individual seller. The Deceptive Trade Practices Act was before the trial court. The requested findings of fact and conclusions of law, although Judge Coker's letter to counsel asked Mr. Chester to prepare the findings of fact and conclusions of law, trial counsel for defendant prepared the first round, took him to the court, signed him, in which he stated that the plaintiff had carried his burden of proof under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The amended findings prepared by Mr. Chester after the court had granted his motion to file his amended findings also said that the plaintiff had carried his burden
under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act.
It is inferentially so, Your Honor, in that the only name that appears ascribed to the findings of fact, the first ones that were withdrawn, are the ones signed by the trial counsel, and the name of the plaintiff's counsel does not appear there at all.
In fact, the counsel may approve something that's formed in the record you prepared there.
I'm suggesting to you, Your Honor, that's what happened. If it's not in the record, especially
well,
the court
that
comes.
All right.
There's no question that, except in a motion for judgment, in the judgment itself, and I would point out to the court that the petitioner has a motion pending before this court to supplement this record and to bring a trial brief filed in the Court of Civil Appeals. And I would simply point out that the issues of the subject trace back to that will brief in this brief. Also, it's a point, I think, that is well settled, that any point not carried forward by point of error in a court of civil appeals is waived, and that any matter brought up in a motion for rehearing that was not previously pointed up by point of error has been waived. Now, there are those cases holding, these are the fundamental error cases in which it is held that if the statute is patently void on its face, then the court can correct an erroneous judgment below and can consider a point not presented to the Court of Civil Appeals by point of error. It seems to me in this case the statute is not patently void, indeed the Court of Civil Appeals so held, and that to rely on these cases where the statutes were patently void seems to me to be an erroneous application of those precedents. In the Lovejoy case, it's a probate case involving a clear violation of equal protection of the laws as held by the United States Supreme Court on legitimization of children. And the trial court considered that, interestingly, and held the statute to be unconstitutional and entered judgment accordingly. In other words, the trial court did consider that matter, and the Court of Civil Appeals sustained that, even though the point of unconstitutionality was not in the pleadings themselves. I submit to Your Honors that that to depart from this well-established rule of requiring pleadings to support unconstitutionality, or at least points of error in the Court of Civil Appeals, invites what happens in this case, at least in my opinion what happened in this case, and that is advisory opinion for courts take a statute and where issues may or may not be involved and write very broadly on it. It seems to me that especially in constitutionality is questioned, that there should be a definite controversy on the specific items in the statute in question, and that these should be hard fought out in the trial court and the Court of Civil Appeals by point of error and not be brought up by motion for rehearing as an afterthought. Next, turning to the broad issues of whether or not intent to deceive is required in Section 1746A, and whether that same kind of requirement, intent to deceive or intent to take advantage of the consumer, is required in Section 1750A3, that is, the cause of action for any unconscionable action or course of action. First is 1746A. This court recognized in State Credit Bureau of Laredo that, and also in the Bar Consultant case, that this court was bound by Section 1752 to look to the precedence of the Federal Trade Commission, construing the Federal Trade Commission Act, in deciding whether or not there is whether or not certain practices are false and misleading. It is clear that in this case, Gimbel versus FTC in many cases stating that intent to deceive is not a part of the plaintiff's case. And none of the cases cited by the Court of Civil Appeals authorize a court to imply or to supply an intent requirement. Some of those cases in analyzing other kinds of statutory language stated that, well, perhaps the intent requirement that was in the statute was helpful in deciding that the statute was not unconstitutional. But no case cited by the Court of Civil Appeals authorized the judicial imposition of an intent requirement. And I would suggest that doesn't make the statute any more precise. That adds no precision to the statute. The language false, deceptive, or misleading is either precise or imprecise, and adding an intent requirement doesn't make that language any more precise or any more certain.
Counsel, it is implicit in the argument you are now making that 1746B13 is not applicable to this transaction.
No, what I'm saying is that B-13 is done exclusively after the transaction. I'm saying that if...
Well, you're not saying B-13 does not require intent, are you?
I am saying that requires a special brand of intent, that which is defined in the Consumer Act. Interestingly, the Court of Civil Appeals said you had to show knowingly and intent to deceive. Statute itself only says knowingly, and that term is specifically defined in statute. The point to be made...
I'm stating the fact that somebody prepared. What are the findings as to whether he knew, the seller knew or did not know?
Did not know that his statements were false and did not make them reckless.
If he did not know, then whether he intended something or not wouldn't help you with 13, would it?
That's right. If the Court of Civil Appeals is correct, and this is probably score hope, that B-13 is exclusively applicable to this case, then the findings of no knowingly and did not know and did not make them recklessly would not support a finding of liability if B-13 is exclusively applicable. And that's simply not the case.
That's my point in asking you if what you're arguing about intent just implicitly, if you exclude the application 13, do you not?
I think that B-13 is not applicable to the case.
Well, I want to be
When you have statements that a product is in perfect condition, excellent condition, just like new, the reason that it's in those conditions has no particular weight to me. There was no statement that, don't worry about this, you won't need any repairs. There are no repairs. The next 5 years, you will not need to repair that. That's clearly a statement about the need for repairs, and not statement as to characteristic quality of a product that may implicitly say to you, well, God, I've got one
what'd you say?
That God?
What's my message here?
I'm sorry. No. That the, I apologize to the court, it will not be sufficient to show that a characteristic uses or benefits. It is sufficient to show characteristic uses or benefits by the statements made by the defendant in the case. But that triggered 5 and 7. It was an express warranty, and it was a false misleading of deceptive act of practice under 46A. And that that it only implicitly and in a tangential way involves repair. No one would dispute the statement in the respondent's brief that the constitutionality of the statute is measured by what a man of common understanding must guess at its meaning. No one would argue that these general precepts of law are not true. But it's also true that the court is obligated to sustain the constitutionality of the statute if at all possible. It seems to me, with the broad and long-standing history of Federal Trade Commission precedent, that the statute is purely constitutional and withstands all possible scrutiny. Thank you.
Court, take a break, please, sir.
May it please the court, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is undoubtedly remedial in the highest sense of that word. The purpose of the act is to protect consumers. No one can stand before this court and tell you that is not a commendable purpose. But as this court noted, and I'm sorry this case is not in our answer to the application for writ of error, International Railway Company versus Mallard, 277.
Excuse me, both sides here have cases which are not in the brief. Would you please simply put them both sides in the letter so we don't have to scribble down this?
Be happy to, thank you. This court noted that, however commendable the objective of an act, and in that case it was a remedial statute as well, That objective does not justify the achievement of that goal by the wrong method. And in that case, the point was raised that the statute did not give fair warning of the conduct that was prohibited. And it's 277 Southwestern, page 1051, this court's opinion in 1925, after the Commission of Appeals was adopted. It's defendant's position, firstly, in this case, that he was convicted in sin under either the general provision, 17.46A, or the provision regarding unconscionability of an innocent misrepresentation, and that neither of those sections gave him fair warning that treble damages would be imposed, or penal damages would be imposed for an innocent misrepresentation. Your Honor, it would be the defendant's position that Section 17.46B is inapplicable to defendant's conduct in its entirety. We contend that not one of the specified subdivisions can, by their terms, apply to defendant's conduct. But alternatively, that some of those terms can be so stretched to apply to this type of conduct, and we are bound by the findings of fact made by the trial court, but if those subdivisions can be so stretched to apply to the conduct found by the trial court, then those words are so flexible as to not give fair notice also. Defendant's position with regard to B-13 is that it also is inapplicable.
That's the hell of a problem. Number 7, representing the goods or services of a particular quality. And one word used by counsel for petition sounds like the representation of quality. Good, new, like new.
The representations were that the goods were in excellent condition, just like new, perfect condition.
You don't think that's quality?
I think that those are statements regarding condition. A boat could be in perfect condition for that type of boat, but it could be a $1,000 boat as opposed to a $6,000 boat. The statement could be perfectly true that the boat was in perfect condition. If it's a $1,000 boat, it may not be of good quality. The term perfect condition do not relate to the term quality, nor do they relate to the characteristics found in 17 or described in 17.46B5. A boat could have characteristics, for example, of being fast, having a quick pickup. Those would be characteristics, but they don't relate.
Well, they could run as one characteristic.
That would be another characteristic.
This block would run?
If Mr. Singleton had represented that this boat would run, I think that that would be a representation of a characteristic. But he represented...
I'm not disagreeing with you, but no problem. He's saying that the motor is in perfect condition. I know that's what it says, something else. But is that not a statement that the motor is fine?
It is a representation of the condition of the motor. Not the quality of the motor, not a characteristic of the motor, certainly not a use of the motor.
For counsel, suppose he had said that this quality is an A1 condition. Would that make it quality?
This boat is in A1 condition?
That's the way they grade A and E, and that means quality.
I believe that the signing of the Court of Civil Appeals was directed towards recognized standards. In a way, if he had said this is in A1 condition, I would have to say that unless that there were recognized standards of conditions, that the statement taken in its entirety would relate to condition and not to quality or standard of grade.
Give me an example of something that relates to quality. About a boat.
In Spradlin, this court found that Section 17.46B7 was applicable. And I think that that also involved a vote. I think also there, the statement that's untrue related to style or model, specifically relating to quality of a vote, I think that you could say that this is a Bonita boat of the most expensive grade. Bonita boats coming in several different grades, different horsepower, different hull shapes. You could say this is a Bonita boat of the most expensive grade. It is of the highest quality. And I think you would have a statement regarding the quality of the boat. I think when you make a statement, this is a Bonita boat, it's in excellent condition, you're describing something entirely different than quality. Again, a boat that is in good condition could be a Bonita boat of the least expensive grade and of inferior quality. Those two terms are not synonymous. It's the defendant's position, of course, that if those terms are synonymous, if quality can be stretched to include and cover condition, then men of common intelligence in reading that statute wouldn't realize that, or at least they wouldn't realize that exclusively. If a statute prohibits a certain course of conduct, it must speak in terms that are so clear that men of common intelligence can understand what they must or must not do. If quality can cover conditions, then I don't believe that this statute speaks so specifically as past the due process.
Well, what yes. about the word standard? In other words, or the particular standard. In other words, when something is perfect, new, excellent, that's a pretty good standard.
Well, possibly this court could look at the first part of the description, perfect, excellent, and new, and find that those words related to standards. But the findings of the trial court state excellent condition, perfect condition, just like new. These are not standards that he says. These are not, this boat is the Bonita boat of the highest standards, the medium standards, the lowest standards. These are representations of the condition of the boat. And I don't believe that condition means the same thing as standard. And of course, this court can look at Webster's International Dictionary and find that these words are different. The Court of Civil Appeals noted in its opinion that condition does not mean the same thing as characteristic, standard, quality. These things are different. Certainly, a person reading the Act would not realize that these words imply that he must not say anything about the condition of the boat, however innocently. And this is a very important part of this appeal. The trial court found that the defendant did not know that his statements were false, and he did not make them recklessly. There is an absolute absence of culpable mental state, which has been found so often to imply or impart that specificity to a statute when challenged under the void for vagueness doctrine. The decisions by the United States Supreme Court are cited and discussed in the brief. I think that an excellent decision to give an overall view of this is Scrooge versus the United States, where Justice Douglas, I believe, discussed the importance of intent, a culpable mental state, and in fact construed the act in question, even though not expressly providing so, to require intent, so that he could avoid holding that act unconstitutional.
Counsel, let me ask you this. If a man does not know, if he is totally ignorant about the condition, the quality, then why should he be making statements that is perfect, excellent, just like you? In other words, he doesn't know anything about it, and yet he's making the sale on the basis that he does know.
In that case, Your Honor, he'd be making those statements recklessly. And as this court held in Custom Leasing versus Texas Bank and Trust, fraud can be premised on either actual knowledge or knowledge of statements made recklessly and without regard for the truth. But that is not the situation in this case. The trial court found that the defendant did not make the statements recklessly because the repairs had been made and he had experienced no difficulty with the boat or motor since the making of the repairs. Your Honor's purpose is correct, that a person that without any justification for making those statements cannot escape liability because he would be making them recklessly. But this judgment is not premised on common law fraud. Although the pleadings do sound in common law fraud, the findings, facts, track identically the elements of common law fraud that this court found in Custom Leasing versus Texas Bank and Trust, with one exception. The culpable mental state does not exist here. Therefore, trial court found that the defendant's statements were false and that they caused an unconscionable result and premised liability under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The falsity of the statement could certainly be prohibited by Section 17.46A. This, of course, prohibits any false, misleading, or deceptive act or practice. Now, in much the same way that the United States Supreme Court cases have held unconstitutionally vague statutes which prohibit unreasonably low prices or conduct which annoys, the Court of Civil Appeals had grave difficulty with how much warning these terms, false, misleading, or deceptive, would give a person of common intelligence in reading the act. In other words, if this defendant were to pick up the act before he was selling this boat and were to say, can I make a statement that the boat is in excellent condition? If I believe it, reasonably, and I have regard to my experience, if I believe it, can I make a statement that it's in excellent condition? He would first come across Section 17.46A. And would the term false tell him that his good faith misrepresentation could hold him accountable for several damages plus attorney's fees, unlimited several damages? I submit to this court that word would not. Defined in most new dictionaries that's available, I looked in Webster's Third International Dictionary. There are approximately 10 different meanings of the word false. They range from erroneous, simply erroneous, all the way down to intentionally misstating a fact. Black Law Dictionary lists several meanings. It states that normally in fact in the word false is some element of culpability, a mental state. Now, if the defendant, as a man of common intelligence, were to be aware of all of these different meanings, could he not, in reading the word false, dream that if I don't know this, I don't make that statement recklessly, then this word would not apply to me? If there are 10 different meanings, and there are at least in Webster's dictionary, I think that the defendant certainly would not be apprised to specificity that good faith in this representation could be penalized by several things.
I'm just trying to find that word this morning. The argument I'm here would put a premium on the statement, and it would free all merchandise if they could employ people who know nothing about product that says that is new, perfect, and in excellent condition. Because the less one knows about product that he says is in excellent condition, that will also be the key of merchant.
My understanding of this court opinion.
May I add to Judge Cook's question that it makes any difference if this fellow is not the merchant in the usual sense?
That's correct.
Well, to me, that makes a difference. Like, I'm talking about just the situation now of the merchandise. If makes a difference to me if I whether this man might be a Mason at all. But if we adopt the rule that you're saying, and I would take it that it would apply to everyone, your construction of innovation representation I'm assuming that that country you're talking about would apply to now what I see the difference between the two factors. I think this court's opinion in the bar consultant would apply directly on the tax factor that he's raised. The merchant that hires somebody, teach him ignorance to the fact and let him go out and misrepresent can still be held liable for his own culpability. I think the fact is not that typically he also.
That was held interest they were charged
with no agreement to do so, and they withheld his any over.
And your contention is QC is not on to that 10% plus rest over.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think I very clearly set that out in about three different pleadings. The last one, which raises the usual question, was in the supplemental petition, supplemental pleading, I forget exactly what it's called, but it was filed May 1979. And I just don't see how it can possibly be construed that when they unilaterally withhold 100% of the money they owe the man, that he has somehow therefore come within the Preston Farms case of having paid any interest. He didn't pay it, they just paid it. This to me is totally different than a voluntary affirmative action on the part of a person in actually paying something. Thank you, Your Honor, for your attention.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Your Honor, the issue in this case, contrary to what the respondent would have believed, is whether or not marine contractors proved that it was usually good. I.e., did it prove the applicability of the 6% rate provided in Section 103? And it is the petitioner's contention that Moraine did not. In light of that, Moraine contends that there is some sort of presumption that the 6% rate applies and that they're entitled to recover penalties without saying anything further. And Your Honor, that this particular contention, Triton contends, is completely out of line with the law with respect to recovery under other penalty provisions, in that the person or the party seeking to recover under those penalty provisions has the burden to establish the applicability of the penalty provisions, and in this case, it requires the establishment of the 6% rate as being applicable, which turns upon the absence of an agreement between the parties. Your Honor, Marine continually refers to the Preston Farm case, which stands for two things. First of all, that the agreement with respect to specified rate does not have to be in writing. This court clearly held that, and also held that an agreement can be evidenced by the conduct of the parties. In this case, it's Triton's contention that there was an agreement evidenced by the conduct of the parties, in that even though Triton was billing marine contractors and the invoices clearly reflected that the 10% rate which was being incurred was being taken out of their share of production, there was no objection by Marine. They did not object to the fact that there was a specified rate. They did not object to the 10% rate.
The other party,
Your Honor, we're contending, we're not contending that that the evidence in the trial court established that there was an agreement. That's not our contention. We don't feel that it's Frighton's burden to establish that there was an agreement. We feel that it was the burden of Marine to establish that there was no agreement and that therefore they were entitled to the penalty provision. In this case, a review of the record, and in particular the aspect that I have mentioned regarding their failure to object, even though they knew that the money was being taken out of their share of production, is some evidence of an agreement. And in light of the other aspects of trial, especially the fact that the trial court judge refused to award these penalty provisions, it's our contention that there was some evidence of an agreement at a rate of 10%. The Marine contractors failed to submit a special issue on that regarding that question. The trial court refused to award them usury penalties, thereby impliedly finding that there was a rate of 10% and that they have therefore waived it. It's a procedural argument, Your Honor. We don't feel it's our burden to establish that there was a 10% rate contrary to the arguments of Marines. In closing, Your Honor, Triton would beg this court to consider the fact that the penalty provision which Marine seeks to recover under are dependent entirely upon a finding that there was no agreement between the parties as to a specified rate of interest. The record reveals that there is some evidence of such an agreement at a rate of 10%. The trial court refused to award the usury penalties, thereby impliedly finding that there was a rate agreed upon of 10%, and that the Marine contractors responded herein is thereby waiving the recovery under such provision of the usage tax.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments of the parties. The court will take the day to recess.
Counsel cited the Pickett decision, as did the Court of Civil Appeals. I reiterate, as pointed out in my application, I believe Pickett is clearly distinguishable from the case of Barr. It's a single transaction, single case, one transaction, all same terms. I just do not believe it's controlled. I would sincerely suggest that if this court is going to adopt the Court of Civil Appeals one transaction theory, one contract theory, that we may as well abolish 2601, that if I own 80 acres of land in my home county, Jefferson County, and I give you a contract that says I deed you 40 acres of land to such and such a survey, that why not compel me to sell that, even though doesn't say which 40 of the 80 acres? Because that could very well happen in this case. The district court has ordered the Joneses to convey 36 acres to the Texas Veterans Land Board, 80-some-odd acres to Mr. Kelly and Mrs. Kelly under a financing agreement. Now, what do we have if the Kellys default on the larger acres? They have a veteran's land title to 36 acres. They have an easement. And I submit my client's only real interest is to reassume possession of the land. True, the documents would indicate they could bring specific performance, but I think, as your honors know, particularly requiring somebody to sign a deed is a lot easier to do than requiring somebody and providing a judicial way to require somebody to pay money, unless they have something to sign.
Price that old land is going up over there every day, isn't it?
It probably is. The price of everything is going up. 7.5% interest looks like the green today.
Most folks would like to get it back.
That might be, Your Honor. I don't dispute that. I don't think Mr. Ebank intended to say that there was any finding by the jury that T-40, which is meets and bounds description, was referred to by the parties, but if he gave that impression, I would point the court to the verdict of the jury. There is no finding that is even reasonably capable of that construction. The surveyor, in his testimony, admits that the 36 acres he surveyed, that the Veterans Land Board later approved financing and that my clients have now been ordered to convey to the Veterans Landlord, did not ever exist prior to May 8, 1977, when he served. He testified that this is unqualifiedly as possible. He says that he squared off the track, he cleaned it up to where he changed it, as the exhibit has been shown to you. I see that I am running close to the deadline. And thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, I will get off of our entire exchange concerning the theories and speculation with regard to the 36 acres and whether there was one agreement or two agreements after I make this one response, because I think it goes to equities in this case. The testimony in the record is replete with a willingness and an ability of Mr. Kelly to take cash 100% for both of the tracks. Judge Thomas allowed this testimony to show the ability and the readiness and the willingness of Mr. Kelly and Mr. Kelly to dissolve the concern of the seller with respect to any default in the future. And the evidence shows that arrangements were made and tender made in open court to pay off the entire balance in full. That testimony was put on without objection. I simply do not think that it holds water to say that the Kellys might have defaulted and to speculate about what could have happened in different financing arrangements. In any event, to my second point on attorneyship. A point of error is that the Court of Civil Appeals erred in holding that the Kellys did not comply with the requirements of pleading and presentment with respect to the issue of attorneyship. This is not correct in fact, and it is not correct in law. Specifically, later in their opinion, the Court of Civil Appeals stated, quote, Kelly did not plead or prove that the presentment or demand for compliance with the contract of sale and failure to comply within 30 days, end quote. This is not correct. Please refer to the transcript, page 37, and paragraph 12 of plaintiff's third amended original petition, which is the one we went to trial on, and the one we relied on then and now, to show the following language, and again I quote. Quote, plaintiff Kelly may demand on defendants to convey the property may be subject of this lawsuit more than 30 days preceding the filing of this action, but said land was not conveyed to any folks. Therefore, plaintiff Kelly were compelled to employ an attorney to protect their claim arising under written contract between the parties. And for that purpose, plaintiffs have retained the services of the law firm of Eubank and Hartlow and have agreed to pay a reasonable fee in the amount of $20,000, which plaintiffs are entitled to recover from defendants under the provisions of Article 2226, end quote. We did plead. It's there in paragraph 12. That's the language we rely on to show that we pled it. And we proved it. Your Honor, we proved it through the testimony of Mr. Kelly as to the attorney-client contract relationship. We proved it as through my testimony, which ran on for two or three pages, as to everything that had been done in this case, which, while it's simple in some respects, it is complex in others. Now, what's it claim and what it presents? Best definition we found is claim is in Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition. It's in our brief. I won't reread it to you. It's at page 4 of our brief. The best definition we've found of presentment, and the only definition we've been able to find in search of all of Black's statutes, all of Vernon's statutes, all of the Texas jurisprudence second, and even the corpus jurisprudentum we have looked to, other than definitions of the word presentment, as contained in Uniform Commercial Code Number Section 3.504. We don't find it anywhere. We don't know what a presentment is other than the one again given in Black's Law Dictionary, which actually cites us back to the Uniform Commercial Code, the very section that we're talking about.
A presentment is laying something before someone for their action. Making known to them that you want something. I certainly am not going to read again to the court, but I do ask the court and invite the court to look at the telephone transcript of Mrs. Kelly's testimony in the record. It is a separate exhibit, one of the last exhibits that was admitted. In there, unequivocally and repeatedly, time and time again, you can hear even the transcript on the tape of Mrs. Kelly's testimony to Mr. Jones that we are going forward with enforcement of this contract. We have hired an attorney. We are insisting upon performance. We will not let you get away with this. We demand that you comply with your agreement. I didn't know about this tape, Your Honor, until about 5 days before trial because I didn't know that the Kellys had the somewhat unusual habit of taping long-distance telephone conferences because they have family members in 3 or 4 different parts of the country. But I found out about it, and we introduced it, and it shows that there was a demand made there. Now, what is the demand in writing? The cases of this court, and I believe there are several, indicate that it's not sufficient to simply make an oral demand, and it's not sufficient to simply file a law. You have to make some kind of clear presentment of what your claim is. We submit that that written presentment is the reaction and the response of Mr. Kelly in his letter replying to Mr. Jones' letter of September 7, 1977 to the VLB reneging on the deal, saying, I'm not going through it. Immediately, Mr. Kelly sat down and wrote a letter with a copy to Mr. Jones saying, we insist on going through with it, and we are retaining legal counsel. And that is in writing, and that's in the record, and Mr. Jones was aware of that. So the two coupled together, we submit, show that there was an adequate and sufficient claim of presentment made under Article 2226 as amended on September 7, 1977. But attorney's fees have always been strictly construed. There's always been a very strict treatment of awarding them. They've never been allowed normally in many cases other than in accounts or certain specified cases of items set forth in Article 2226. But that law is gone, Your Honor. That law has changed. We have researched the legislative history on this and invite the court to inquire into it. In 1977, the law was changed to permit, effective August 29, 1977, to permit, quote, suits founded on oral or written contract, end quote. In June 1979, the legislature again declared its will, quote, this act shall be liberally construed to promote its underlying purposes. The court went on to give this court and every court in this state judicial discretion to take notice of what the reasonable and customary attorney fees are without evidence, even when there's an opponent, when the suit is to the court, and upon agreement of the party, even when to submit that question to the court, even where there's a jury. So the law is changing radically since the time of the notice that went out to Mr. Jones. Again, in 1979, we find very, very meaningful language in the legislative changes. Quote, this act is remedial in character and is intended to apply to all pending and future actions, regardless of the time of institution thereof or the accrual of any cause of action asserted, end quote. So it covers this case. I'm aware, Your Honor, because I've searched very hard that and been unable to locate any case in Texas where attorney fees have ever been awarded on the claim of anyone who demanded specific performance in a written contract where the right of specific performance is given as a part of the claim in the contract. That's our fact in this case. Each of the earned money contracts say that the Kellys had the right of specific performance. They claimed that right. They demanded that right. They fought for it. If they're not awarded attorney's fees, and they win on a specific performance, they still lose. Because they're people of moderate means, and they wanted this farm for their retirement, as the record shows. And they cashed in their life savings to get it. And Mr. Kelly, as the testimony shows in the record, did away with half of his potential profit-sharing rights in order to find money and get money so that he could go through with this deal. The equities are in favor of Kelly, and attorney's fees would make it truly equitable. Some states, many states, like Alaska, have gone to plainly and straightforwardly having their legislatures enact statutes that say attorney's fees will be paid to the prevailing party. And that's fair. Because all the... May I say one more thing? I see my time. And that's fair. Thank you very much.
All right. Stop winding this one back. Go ahead.
Please, the court. I'll be as brief as possible. Article 2226, as Mr. Ebing stated, was amended in 1977, and those amendments were effective, as he stated, on August 29, 1977. Significantly, the 77 amendment did not provide that those changes would be applicable to all pending or future actions. The 79 amendment, significantly, the amendment which allowed the court to take judicial notice of a certain claim for attorney fees, made such provision. We think that distinction is significant. We also believe, in view of the conflict in the evidence, as to the time at which the contract was repudiated, that it is not conclusive on this record that the plaintiff's cause of action arose after the effective date of the 77 amendment, and therefore it was incumbent upon the plaintiff to obtain a finding on that. As to his claim of presentment and failure to comply, he purports to meet the Court of Civil Appeals' criticism of presentment as far as his pleading. Nowhere does counsel for the Kelly suggest that he has obtained any findings from the jury that such a presentment was made or that a failure to comply existed, nor do I understand him to suggest that that's undisputed in the record. The only further comment I have, unless there's some questions, is to quote briefly again from this court's decision in Morrow versus Shotwell. In language which was emphasized by the court, thus resort to extrinsic evidence where proper at all is not for the purpose of supplying the location or description of the land. And we submit that's exactly what this case turns on. I thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor, all awards of attorney fees are incident to some other action, some other lawsuit, some other claim. Claims for attorney fees don't exist in a vacuum. So we submit that it is well within the proper determination of this court to award attorney fees on the law as it exists today, applicable to this case, under Article 2226 as amended, incident to the breach of contract by the Jones upon the claim and demand and written and oral presentment of the Kelly. There is no logical distinction between the two kinds of cases, that is, a specific performance suit as a contract and a contract to buy a bale of hay. Both are contracts which can be breached, and both, if the bale of hay were unique enough, to be specifically enforced.
Counsel, one question. Are we not bound by the Court of Civil Appeals finding that there was no presentment?
Your Honor, I do not think so. I think you can examine what they examined to determine whether they were correct in that determination or not. And I disagree that any jury issue was necessary on this. I say that, so I think my answer to both opposing counsel's point and your question is the same. Where there's no mistake, there's no need for the submission of an issue on mistake. Where there's no question in our minds about presentment.
You said he had the suggest contend that there was no presentment?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I do. And I think that if he didn't protest at that time, there's an implied finding of it by the clear award of attorney's fees on two special issues of the 9 issues presented to the jury, all of which they answered in less than 55 minutes after a 6-day trial, all favorably to the judge. I believe that is contained in an implied witness finding that we are entitled to reasonable attorney's fees. We submit, Your Honor, that the legal description is sufficient. It existed at the time of the signing of the agreement. There's not two or three or more agreements. There's one agreement to sell one farm by one couple to another couple. We submit that attorney's fees have been pled adequately and that they have been proved adequately, and that the time has come to follow the more modern trend and the clear directive of the legislature as given in the last 2 years in their award and agreement.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments of both parties. We'll take a brief recess.